Dr. Robert Vinoy, Exodus to Exile, Lecture 2A. We were discussing Exodus 1 through 11, quote, the deliverance from Egypt, end quote. And we were under B on your lecture outline, quote, the historical setting, end quote, or, quote, the problem of the date of the Exodus, end quote. The 18th dynasty date is called the early date for the Exodus, around 1446 BC. The 19th dynasty date is called the late date for the Exodus, around 1250 BC. We looked at some of the major arguments that have been advanced initially for the late date. I think by far the strongest argument is the first one. Exodus chapter 1 verse 11 says that the Israelites were placed in forced labor to build these storage cities for Pharaoh. The Pharaoh, of course, is not named. That is part of the problem. But the store cities were Python and Ramses. Of course, Ramses was a 19th dynasty pharaoh, so we discussed the additional arguments that were less strong, because they were largely arguments from silence or inference. The second argument was the archaeological surveys of Transjordan by Nelson Gluck. He was concerned that there wasn't sedentary population in Transjordan, that is, in the areas of Moab and Edom, for 5 centuries prior to 1300. So if you had an early date for the Exodus, there wouldn't have been any settled population in Moab. Yet, when you read in Numbers, the Moabites came out and forced the Israelites to go around. They had fields and vineyards. That sounds like a sedentary population at the time of the Exodus and the conquest. The third argument was on the basis of the destruction levels in certain Canaanite cities there that are mentioned in the book of Joshua as having been taken by Joshua at the time of the conquest. Those destruction levels were in the time of 1250 to 1200 BC, which is the end of what is called the Late Bronze Age. Now, of course, the question then becomes, who was the agent of destruction? Was it the Israelites at the time of the conquest? That's an assumption. It might have been, but it's by no means certain. But that's one of the arguments for the late date, those destruction levels at the end of the Late Bronze Age. The fourth argument is an argument from silence. There is no reference in the Book of Judges to the Palestinian campaigns of the pharaohs Seti and Ramses. We know Seti and Ramses marched their armies through the land of Canaan. If the conquest had taken place in the 1400s, you'd be in the period of Judges at the time of Seti and Ramses. Why is there a reference to other oppressing peoples, but absolutely no reference to the Egyptians? Then the last thing I mentioned really isn't an argument for the late date, but it sets a terminus for the late date, from what's called the Merneptah inscription, where he mentions Israel. Sometimes it's called the Israelite stele, or the Merneptah stele. It can be dated with his reign approximately at 1220. So here you say, as far as a end terminus for the late date, you can't push it down below 1220 on the basis of extra-biblical references to Israel in Canaan. Towards the end of our class session, I began the argument for the early date, the 18th century dynasty date. And again, the first argument I think is the strongest, and that's based on the text of 1 Kings 6:1, which is 480 years after the Exodus, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign, he began to build the temple. And here you get the time. We can date the fourth year of Solomon's reign to 966 to 967, add 480 years, and you get an early date at 1446 BC. So then you'd be back at the time of Thutmose and Amenhotep, for the Pharaoh of the oppression and the Pharaoh of the Exodus. The second argument that we looked at was that Thutmose III was a great builder with a long lifespan. We know he put a lot of people to work in his building projects. We also know he had a long lifespan, which fits with the chronology of Moses' long life. So that's the second argument. It used to be said that there's no evidence of the 18th dynasty construction up in the delta part of Egypt. But in the 1990s, evidence was found of 18th dynasty construction in the delta area. So that evidence counters that argument. The third argument we looked at, which is not very strong, is the references to Habiru in the Amarna letters, which are letters between city-states and kings in Canaan and the Egyptian pharaohs that talked about attacks by these people called the Habiru. Then the question becomes, are the Habiru really Hebrews? A lot of people who tended to sound a lot alike were grouped as Habiru. I mentioned last week K.A. Kitchen's statement that the Hebrews may have been Habiru, but not all Habiru were Hebrew. The designation, quote, Habiru, end quote, seems to be more identified with a social class rather than an ethnic group. They seem to have been nomadic kinds of people that wandered around, settled from time to time, and who were mercenary in character. But they were all over the Middle East for a long span of time. There are even Habiru in Egypt after the Hebrews left. So that whole issue is not totally clear, although some have attempted to use it as support for an early date for the conquest by equating the Habiru with the Hebrew group of people. There's one additional argument that I want to mention that has sometimes been used, but again, which is not totally clear or unchallenged, and that is an argument from the excavations at Jericho, the city that Joshua took immediately after crossing the Jordan River and entering the land of Canaan. There's been a long history of excavation at that site. Initially, excavations were done by the Germans in the early 1900s, and later in the 1930s by an Englishman called John Garstang. John Garstang concluded that the city was destroyed around 1400 BC. And if you look at his case for that, you would say that it fits an early date, if 1446 is the time of the Exodus. You take off 40 years in the wilderness, and you come up to the time of Canaan, about 1400. So after the 1930s, there's a fair degree of consensus. Archaeology had connected to the conquest and had corroborated precisely what the Bible says. But then in the 1950s, there was another English archaeologist by the name of Kathleen Kenyon. Kathleen Kenyon did a lot of the excavations there, and she came to the conclusion that the level of the site that Garstang assigned to the time of the conquest was wrongly done. She concluded that the level was really a destruction about 2300 BC, long before any possible time that the Israelites could have been the agents of that destruction. Then she said, after that 2300 BC destruction, the city was rebuilt and was then again destroyed at the end of the Middle Bronze Age. The Middle Bronze Age is 2000 to 1500. She said it was destroyed again at about 1580, shortly before the end of the Middle Bronze Age. That would have been also prior to the time of the Israelite conquest on the basis of an early date, but she said, subsequent to that, the site was really unoccupied. There was no significant levels from 1500 down to 1200, so her work raised a host of questions about the conclusions Garstang had come to. Then the question was raised as to whether archaeology supports an Israelite conquest at almost any time, because down to 1200, you would think even then there would have been more significant destruction on the site. I passed out a sheet that has a photocopy of a short article from Time Magazine, March 5, 1990. The article is a brief summary of an article published in BAR, that is, Biblical Archaeology Review, written by Bryant G. Wood, entitled, quote, "Did the Israelites Conquer Jericho?" End quote. What Bryant Wood did was go back over the reports published by Kathleen Kenyon on her excavations at Jericho. Kathleen Kenyon, by the time Wood wrote his article, was already long gone. She died in 1978. She lived from 1906 to 1978. She was the director of the British School of Archaeology in Jerusalem. She was obviously a respected scholar. She published her findings from the excavation she did at Jericho and drew her conclusions. Bryant Wood went back over her published excavation reports and used those reports to draw different conclusions from the evidence that Kathleen Kenyon had drawn. So you may look at that summary of Bryant Wood's article from the summary in Time magazine. You notice in the end of the first paragraph, the writer of this article says, quote, "The late British archaeologist Kathleen Kenyon established in the 1950s that while the ancient city was indeed destroyed, it happened around 1550 BC, some 150 years before Joshua could have shown up." But archaeologist Bryant Wood, writing in the March/April issue of Biblical Archaeology Review, claims that Kenyon was wrong. Based on a reevaluation of her research, which was published in detail only recently, Wood says the city walls could have come tumbling down at just the right time to match the biblical account, end quote. I don't think that's so much the point here, just looking to see what evidence there is or isn't. But the next paragraph, quote, "Kenyon's date of Jericho's destruction was based largely on the fact that she failed to find the decorative pottery imported from Cyprus that was popular in the region around 1400 BC, end quote. Now notice, again, that's negative evidence. She didn't find something, not that she did find something. The fact that she didn't find something. Quote, "Its absence," she reasoned, "meant the city had long since become uninhabited." But Wood, an ancient pottery expert, now at the University of Toronto, argues that Kenyon's excavations were made in a poor part of the city, where the expensive imported pottery would have been absent in any case. As he says that other pottery dug up in Jericho in the 1930s was common in 1400 BC, end quote. So you get a discussion of the evidence, and to some extent, into this question is the absence of evidence. Just because you don't find it, does that mean it wasn't there? There was lots of it that wasn't found. He gives other reasons for coming to the conclusion that it was destroyed around 1400 BC. If you look at the third column, second paragraph, it talks about radiocarbon dating, but then at the end of that, quote, "Egyptian amulets found in Jericho graves can be dated around 1400 BC, end quote. So it sounds like it was indeed inhabited around 1400. Wood is saying, quote, "Looks to me as though the biblical stories are correct," end quote. So that discussion really is ongoing. I might say we'll come back to that when we look at the book of Joshua in the early chapters where it speaks about the dating of Jericho. We'll look at that in a little more detail, but I want to mention that most of the late Bronze Age materials, 1500 to 1200 BC, of the Jericho Mound has been removed either by erosion and simply mining of whatever was there by people, as well as archaeological work on the mound. Particularly the early Germans who disturbed the mound and who didn't have the types of methods we have today to report everything and take pictures of everything, and a lot of the late Bronze Age mound is gone and will never be recovered. So I think that it will be difficult to draw conclusions on the basis of the destruction of Jericho. But if you agree with John Garstang's original conclusions, and then Bryant G. Wood's conclusions, drawn from the reports from Kathleen Kenyon, you come up with the 1400 date for the conquest of Jericho, which fits in with the early date of the Exodus. So these are the arguments for the early and late date for the Exodus. I think you can see that we could spend a lot of time on each one of them in much more detail. I don't think it warrants time in this course to do that, however. I think you can see from what we have said, this is going to be an ongoing discussion, but I don't think there are any conclusive arguments on either side, but the discussion will go on. I want just to mention a couple things that, at least in my mind, weigh the balance of evidence toward an early date to conclusion. I tend to think the time was the 18th dynasty rather than the 19th dynasty, and a couple comments in that regard. First thing I want to mention is that chronology of the period of the judges is much more difficult to harmonize with the late date than with the early date. The reason for that is, if you take the late date, say 1290 for the Exodus, 966 for the fourth year of Solomon's reign, you have only 324 years to work with. 324 years. For a late date, there are 324 years between the time of the Exodus, 1290, to 966 BC. If you take the early date, 1446 to 966, you have 480 years. If you look at the book of Judges and add up all the chronological references in the book, sometimes times of oppression and rest cycles, you get around 410 years. And then you have to add to that the time of Eli to Solomon's fourth year. Eli was a judge at the beginning of 1 Samuel. So you have Eli, you have Saul, you have David, and you go on to Solomon. That is another 116 years, minimally. And you have to add the years of the wilderness wanderings. There's another 40 years. You have to add that time on Joshua after the time of the conquest. So all the book of Joshua, say you add another 10 years, what do you get there? You get 576 years. Now obviously the real problem here is those chronological figures in the book of Judges. There must have been overlap between the times of oppression and rest, and there must have been more regional times of situations than national, and that's fine. If you have 576 years, that doesn't fit into 480 years either. Even with the early date of the Exodus, you have to have overlaps. You have to compress. My point is that it's much more difficult to compress that 576 down to 324 than it is into 480. So it seems to me that chronology in the book of Judges more likely points you toward an early date for the Exodus rather than the late date for the Exodus. Second comment. One of the arguments of the late date that we mentioned was the destruction levels of Canaanite cities in the end of the Late Bronze Age, 1250 to 1200, as being evidence for the Israelite conquest at that time. That argument is increasingly coming into question. How many cities were said to be destroyed, explicitly destroyed, and burned? Just three, that's all. Jericho, Ai, and Hazor. It says that in others he conquered and killed the people. It doesn't say he destroyed the city. So people were beginning to talk about a modified conquest of the cities in the sense that when Israel came into the conquest, they didn't completely destroy all these cities. They came in and settled down in these cities and lived there, although they did kill the inhabitants. But we shouldn't be looking for destruction levels in all these cities. So then the question is, who were the agents of destruction from 1250 to 1200? All you can do is speculate. If you go back to that 19th dynasty, Merneptah, that's the one you had that inscription about Israel being back in the land of Canaan, talks about raids up into the land of Canaan. Maybe some of the cities were destroyed by Merneptah. At about 1200, there was an attack on Egypt by what are called the Sea Peoples, most of whom came from Crete. Those Sea Peoples were repulsed by the Egyptians. In other words, the Egyptians forced them off. So they came up and settled in the southern coast of the land of Canaan in the area of Gaza and the coastal plain. They became the Philistines. Now, of course, we know the Philistines were the problem with the Israelites in the time of the Judges. But that was about 1200 BC. Maybe the Philistines were the agents of destruction when they came in and settled where some of those towns had been. Maybe some of those sites were destroyed by the Israelites in the struggles with the Canaanites during the period of the Judges. It's hard to say, but I don't think you can say that the destruction levels of those cities at 1250 to 1200 is necessarily a strong argument for the late date of the Exodus. So that is being increasingly questioned. If you look at Hazor, for example, one of the sites that is said to have been destroyed by Joshua, there were destruction levels at Hazor at 1400, 1300, and 1230. Now, it's often been argued that this 1230 destruction is during the time of the Israelite conquest. But that's not the only destruction level at Hazor. You go into these destruction levels, and there are no signposts that say this city was destroyed by whomever. It's an open question. Now, one further comment on this, and this is where this really gets complicated. There's a book listed in your bibliography by John Bimpson called Redating the Exodus and the Conquest. John Bimpson wrote a book-length treatment of this in which he gets into very technical arguments, but the point of his argument is to change the dating of the archaeological period for the Exodus. I have on the overhead there the traditional way of dating archaeological periods, and how you establish periods is a complex matter in itself. But what he argues is that the Middle Bronze Age, which traditionally ends at 1500, should be pushed down closer to 1400. So he wants the date of the end of the Middle Bronze Age to be lowered by a century approximately. Now, there are destruction levels at a number of these sites at the end of the Middle Bronze Age. And if you lower the date of the Middle Bronze Age into the 1400s, then those destruction levels at the end of the Middle Bronze Age will be moved down into the 1400s. In that way, even Kathleen Kenyon's 1930 date for the destruction of Jericho is going to be down into the 1400s. That is an ongoing discussion and argument. I think, by way of conclusion, if you look at your citations, page 7, middle of the page, down to the bottom from an essay by the founder of this institution, Alan McRae, on this question of the date of the Exodus. I'm not going to read those paragraphs, but go to his last paragraph on page 8. He says, quote, "The arguments as to the early or late date of the Exodus often seem to be given in a manner of a lawyer determined to prove a particular point, rather than of a researcher seeking for light in order to determine something that is not yet known. Some new discovery may make the matter absolutely final, but up to the present, it must be considered a question on which we do not yet have sufficient light." End quote. Now, he wrote that many years ago. I do not think the situation has changed dramatically since that time. If anything, I think the evidence is stronger for an early date conclusion today. I think what he is arguing for is proper methodology and mental attitude toward issues of this sort. I think he's right. We should be looking for the information that might help to clarify the picture rather than get on the crusade that if you don't agree with an early date for the Exodus that some people suggest, then you don't really take the Bible seriously, because 1 Kings 6:1 says, quote, 480 years after the Exodus was the fourth year of Solomon's reign, end quote, quote, proving, end quote, the early date, 1446. There are people like that. I think McRae's approach is the proper approach given the evidence. All right, let's go on to C, which is the oppression in Exodus chapter 1:1-2:25, and we'll get into the biblical text. If you look at the oppression in those first two chapters of Exodus, as well as chapter 5 in reference to making bricks with or without straw, I think what you see is that there were several phases of oppressions over a period of time. The reason that the Egyptians felt they should put the Israelites to work was because of their multiplication and numbers. You read in chapter 1, verse 7, quote, "The Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly and became exceedingly numerous, so the land was filled with them," end quote. What that statement tells us confirms what had been going on since the late chapters of Genesis. If you look at Genesis chapter 47, verse 27, when Joseph's brothers and his father eventually followed him to Egypt and settled down, we read, quote, "The Israelites settled in Egypt, in the region of Goshen. They acquired property there and were fruitful and increased greatly in number," end quote. So already in the time of Joseph, it's telling you that the Israelites were increasing. There's a 480-year period between the end of Genesis and the opening of Exodus. In chapter 1, verse 7 of Exodus, it says that they are becoming exceedingly numerous. So the Pharaoh says in verse 10, quote, "Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous. And if war breaks out, they will join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country," end quote. I think what's interesting there is they really don't want them to leave the country. They want them to stay there. What they want is to exploit them and use them and benefit from their presence, but they want to control them. So they determine to put slave masters over them, verse 11. They put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor. And that's the first phase, you might say, of the oppression or bondage. Now, some have said this oppression is the first example of anti-Semitism in human history, something that's been going on from that day until today. It's remarkable that it seems to be something that is still with us. You might say that, but I think there's more than that, something deeper with more significance than just anti-Semitism. I think the root of what you find here is an expression of something rooted back in Genesis 3:15, or after the fall of man into sin. God says there will be conflict between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent, Satan. You have the kingdom of God in opposition to the kingdom of Satan. You have two kingdoms that clash with and are at enmity with each other. Here is a manifestation of that enmity between those two peoples. So the first step of that first phase is to put slave masters over the Israelites to afflict them, so that they won't become too numerous or powerful, so that they could become a threat to Egypt's own security by siding with Egypt's enemies. But the problem is, as soon as they do that, what happens? Verse 12, quote, "The more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread," end quote. The oppression didn't work, so the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. So what did they do? That first stage of oppression has a second step. They turn to scourge them. They oppress them more. Verse 14, quote, "They made their lives bitter with hard labor, brick and mortar, with all kinds of work in the fields. And through all their hard labor, the Egyptians used them ruthlessly," end quote. They increased the oppression, hoping to control the multiplication of the Israelites. So they make the bondage more severe. So the first phase is hard bondage in two steps. But that doesn't work. So there's a second phase of oppression, and that is killing the male children. Again, you have two steps. The first step is in verse 16, where the Pharaoh tells the Hebrew midwives, quote, "When you help the Hebrew women in childbirth and observe the ones on the delivery stool, if it is a boy, kill him. If it is a girl, let her live," end quote. At least there they thought they could control the method of military threat by killing the males. But again, that is frustrated because the Hebrew midwives don't cooperate. We read in the next verse, quote, "The Hebrew midwives feared God and didn't do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. but let the boys live, end quote. So you get a second step there, and instead of just these midwives being instructed to kill the male children of the Hebrews, you read in verse 18 that the king summoned and asked them why. Then in verse 22, Pharaoh gave this order to all his people. Every boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile. So in Exodus chapter 1, verse 22, that mandate to kill all the male children is extended to all the Egyptian people to cast every male child into the Nile. It doesn't say explicitly every Hebrew male child, but I think in this context that is what is in focus. Every Hebrew male child, cast him into the Nile River. So two steps again. Nahum Sarna, who writes the Exodus commentary in the Jewish Publication Society on Exodus, makes this comment, quote, faced with an irreconcilable conflict between obedience to the sovereign's depraved law and allegiance to the higher moral law of God, the midwives chose in favor of the transcendent imperative of morality. Their noncompliance with the law, however, was not publicly announced but privately effected on obvious prudential grounds, end quote. This tyranny constitutes, quote, history's first reported act of civil disobedience in defense of a moral imperative, end quote. That's an interesting statement, quote, civil disobedience in defense of a moral imperative, end quote. Pharaoh tells the midwives, kill all the male children, and it says they feared God. They did not do what the king of Egypt told them to do. They let the boys live. He goes on to say, it is stated that they were actuated by the fear of God and praise frequently associated with norms of moral and ethical behavior. Fear of God connotes a conception of God as one who makes moral demands on humankind. It functions as the ultimate restraint on evil and thus supreme stimulus for good. Fear of God, stimulus for good, the ultimate restraint on behavior. You do away with God, and there is no restraint. But you notice what happens here. All these efforts are frustrated so that after that command to all the Egyptians, throw any male child into the Nile River, what happens? Moses is born, and he's put in that basket, and his life is preserved, and he grows up in the house of Pharaoh and ultimately becomes the Savior who delivers Israel out of Egyptian bondage. So the text highlights the futility of these efforts of the Egyptians to control the Israelites among them. I mention here chapter 5 as another chapter that is part of the oppression. Exodus chapter 5 is after Moses comes back and asks Pharaoh for permission to go into the wilderness and worship the Lord. Pharaoh doesn't grant that permission, but what does he do? We read in verse 6 of chapter 5, quote, the same day Pharaoh gave this order to the slave drivers and foremen in charge of the people. You are no longer to supply the people with straw for making bricks. Instead, make them gather their own straw, but require them to make the same number of bricks as before, end quote. So apparently, straw was used in some way for making bricks, and it was supplied. But now, because of his request, Pharaoh intensifies the oppression by not providing the straw, telling them they have to find their own straw. You go down to verse 12, where we read, quote, the people scattered all over Egypt to gather stubble to use for straw. The slave drivers kept pressing them, saying, quote, complete the work required of you for each day just as when you had straw, end quote. And the foreman appointed by Pharaoh's slave drivers beating them, saying, why didn't you meet your quota just as the day before, end quote. Verse 18, quote, you will not be given any straw. You must produce your full quota of bricks, end quote. The end of this chapter tells about the way the oppression was intensified by withholding straw, the Israelites being forced to get their own straw and sometimes having to use stubble instead of straw. This raises the question of what the function of the straw was in making bricks. look at the bottom of page 8 over to page 11 in the bottom of your citations. This is taken from, quote, The Relation of Archaeology to the Bible, end quote, by Alan McCrae, where he discusses this, and what he points out is that it used to be thought that straw was used as a binding agent. In other words, if you've got a long piece of straw going through the brick, it kind of holds the clay together as a binding agent. But the problem with that was, how then did the stubble function? What's the point if you can't get long strands of straw? What's the point of putting stubble into brick? He cites some scientific experiments that indicate that the placing of the organic material in certain kinds of clay makes the clay more workable, more plasticity, by means of some chemical reaction. What McCrae suggests is that the Egyptians had discovered something that they might not have understood all the chemistry of, but if you mix organic matter with clay, it made it easier to mold the bricks out of clay than if you didn't have organic material. It's just an interesting side feature to that third intensification of the oppression on Israel. So that's all under the oppression, Exodus chapter 1:1 through 2:25, and chapter 5. Look at your citations, page 11, bottom of the page. J. Mottier, who published lectures called Old Testament Covenant Theology, makes this statement about this oppression. He says, quote, even more significant than the actual occurrence of the word, quote, covenant, end quote, is the situation in which the book of Exodus is set. I have already mentioned the genocidal impulses of Pharaoh. This is the content of chapter 1. The king of the world, Pharaoh, had determined on the utter destruction of this people, end quote. Now, I don't think Pharaoh was determined on utter destruction. I think he wanted to control them, but I don't think that really affects his point very much. He says, quote, little did he know that he was in this way challenging the promise that God had made to Abraham. In other words, the most fundamental reality about the people of Israel. For at the beginning of God's dealing with Abraham, as he then was in chapter 12, there was the promise of the preservation of Abram and his descendants. God said, I will bless those who bless you, and him who curses you I will curse. Pharaoh, therefore, all unwitting, was setting himself up to challenge the covenant. When his covenant was challenged, God rose to defend it, end quote. He was oppressing the very people that God said, quote, whoever blesses you I will bless, whoever curses you I will curse, end quote. Quote, therefore, both its vocabulary and also its own chosen setting proclaim to us that the book of Exodus is the continuation of the covenant narrative, end quote. In other words, that promise that God had given to Abraham, that God would raise up a seed through Abraham, that a nation would come out of Abraham, and that he would put his blessing on that nation, that is continuing on. That is still something that is very actual in all this interaction between the Egyptians and the Israelites in the early chapters of Exodus. Let's go on to D. Quote, the Deliverer, Exodus chapter 3, verse 1 to chapter 7, verse 13. Of course, the Deliverer is Moses, who is born right after that final phase of the killing of the male generation at the end of chapter 1. Chapter 2, Moses is born and becomes the leader who delivers Israel out of Egypt. Moses is certainly one of the greatest personalities of the entire Bible. When we think of the great characters of the Bible, we think of Moses, Abraham, David, and Christ in the New Testament. But he's one of the great personalities of all human history. I don't think there is any question about that. His historicity, that is, his real existence as a historical person in the historical context in which these narratives are set, I would say today is generally accepted, but not completely. There are still Bible critics around who question whether or not Moses was a real historical figure, or some sort of legendary or mythical creation from ancient fairy tales. John Van Cedars, who is a very active Old Testament scholar, has written a number of books. His article in the Encyclopedia of Religion and Moses, published in 1987, says, quote, "The quest for the historical Moses is a futile exercise. He now belongs only to legend," end quote. In other words, there's an example of somebody who doesn't think Moses ever lived. The German scholars Martin Note and Gerhard van Rood both wrote World Histories of Israel and ascribe a relatively minor role to Moses. They feel Israel didn't have a people in a mass exodus that came up into the land of Canaan. So you have these kinds of negative critics around. But if you look at your citations on page 12, the second entry there is from the third edition of John Bright's The History of Israel. John Bright was a student of W.F. Albright, who wrote a standard text on the history of Israel. Notice what he says, quote, "Though we know nothing of his career save what the Bible tells us," end quote. In other words, there are no extra biblical references to Moses. That's one of the reasons his existence is questioned. Quote, "The details of which we have no means of testing. There can be no doubt that he was, as the Bible portrays him, the great founder of Israel's religion. Attempts to reduce him are extremely unconvincing. The events of Exodus and Sinai require a great personality behind them, and a faith as unique as Israel's demands a founder as surely as does Christianity or Islam, for that matter. To deny that role to Moses would force us to posit another person of the same name," end quote. Actually, we do know quite a bit about the life of Moses, admittedly based entirely on the biblical records. But why should the biblical record be disqualified as a source of information about the lives of individuals of Israel during the time of Moses? We'll come across quite a bit of material when we progress about Moses. I think as far as his significance or importance, Voss puts it pretty well, again on page 12 of your citations, where he looks at Moses both retrospectively and prospectively. He says, quote, "For one thing, he was retrospectively considered instrumental in bringing the great patriarchal promises to an incipient fulfillment, at least in their external provisional embodiment. Israel became, in truth, a great nation, and was due not exclusively to their rapid increase. The organization received through Moses enabled them to attain national coherence. Moses, likewise, led them to the border of the promised land," end quote. That is Jericho in the land of Canaan. Moses came right to the verge of the entrance into the promised land, looked across and saw it, but didn't actually enter. So, retrospectively, Moses brings the patriarchal promises to incipient fulfillment. Moses occupies a dominant place in the religious development of the Old Testament. He's also placed not merely at the head of the succession of the prophets, but over them in advance. There was no prophet like Moses. He was not just a prophet, but the greatest of all the prophets. His authority extends over subsequent ages. The later prophets did not create anything new, although they did predict some things. The later prophets call Israel back to the foundation Moses laid. Now, they do talk about the things God will do in the future, beyond their own time. But fundamentally, they call Israel back to its Mosaic foundation. Voss goes on to say, quote, "It is true, Moses can be coordinated with the prophets. Nevertheless, the prophets themselves are clearly conscious of the unique position of Moses. They put his work not so much on the line with their own as with the stupendous eschatological work of Jehovah for his people expected in the later days. According to Numbers chapter 12, verse 7, Moses was set over God's house. It is entirely in keeping with this prospective import of Moses and his work, that his figure acquires typical proportions to an unusual degree. He may be fittingly called the Redeemer of the Old Testament," end quote. And, of course, in that sense, he is looking forward to Christ. Quote, Nearly all the terms in use for the redemption of the New Testament can be traced back to his time, end quote. We're not going to work that out with his birth, but his redemption was certainly a very significant event with what's going on in the Exodus in the land of Egypt. So those are some comments about Moses. Let's go on to E. Quote, the plagues, Exodus chapter 7, 14 through 11, 10, end quote. I might mention the plagues are also described in poetic narratives in Psalm chapter 78, verses 43 through 51, and Psalm 105, verses 27 to 36. They are historical psalms that go back in poetic form, recording the events of Israel's history. Of course, the Exodus was the significant event that led to Israel's formation. It's been common to refer to these series of miraculous occurrences that led to Pharaoh's release of the Israelites from bondage as, quote, plagues, end quote. That is a term that's used in the biblical text. If you look at 9:14, you read, quote, for this time I will send the full force of my plagues against you and against your officials and your people, end quote. The full force of my plagues. That's the word that comes from Naga. But more often these, quote, plagues, end quote, are referred to in the biblical text as either signs or wonders. Signs are Ot, and wonder is Mofet. The NIV interestingly translates that, quote, wonder, end quote, sometimes as, quote, miracle, end quote. But, quote, signs and wonders, end quote, are used more often than, quote, plagues, end quote, to designate the series of divine interventions that led to the Exodus from Egypt. And I think that language, signs and wonders, is helpful because it gives us more insight into the significance and intent of these events. When you ask what was God doing and what was his intent in bringing these series of events on the Egyptians and the Israelites, I think you have to start looking at Moses' request to Pharaoh. Quote, let the Israelites go into the wilderness and worship, end quote. In chapter 5, the first few verses, you read, quote, Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh, and this is what Yahweh, end quote. The NIV says, the Lord or Yahweh, the proper name of Israel's deity. Perhaps we don't know how it is pronounced. Quote, this is what Yahweh, the God of Israel, says. Let my people go so that they may go and worship in the desert, end quote. What's Pharaoh's response? Quote, who is Yahweh that I should obey him and let Israel go? I do not know Yahweh, and I will not let Israel go, end quote. If you go to chapter 7, verse 3, there the Lord says, quote, I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and though I multiply my miraculous signs and wonders in Egypt, he will not listen to you. Then I will lay my hand on Egypt with mighty acts of judgment. I will bring out my division, my people, the Israelites, and the Egyptians will know that I am Yahweh when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring the Israelites out of it. End quote. In other words, why this series of signs and wonders? Pharaoh had said, quote, I don't know Yahweh. Why should I let you go and worship Yahweh? End quote. These signs and wonders are done so that Pharaoh will know who Yahweh is, that he exists, and that he's powerful. That becomes a theme that really runs through here. The plagues are Yahweh's answer to Pharaoh's question in chapter 5, verse 2. Who's Yahweh? I don't know Yahweh. We looked at chapter 7, verse 5, and now look at chapter 7, verse 16 and 17. Quote, then say to him, Pharaoh, Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews, has sent me to say to you, let my people go so that they may worship me in the desert, but until now you have not listened. This is what Yahweh says. By this you will know that I am Yahweh. End quote. Who is Yahweh? I don't know Yahweh. Look at 9:13 and following. Quote, the Lord said to Moses, get up early in the morning to confront Pharaoh and say to him, "This is what Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews, says, let my people go so that they may worship me. At this time I will send the full force of my plagues against you, against your people, against your officials." End quote. Why? Quote, "So that you may know that there is no one like me in the whole earth." End quote. Chapter 9, verse 16. Quote, "For by now I could have stretched my hand and struck you and your people with plague that would have wiped you off the earth." End quote. He could have done that instantaneously. He doesn't. Quote, "But I have raised you up for this very purpose, that I might show you my power, and that my name might be proclaimed in all the earth." End quote. Yahweh is going to demonstrate who he is, and that he is powerful, so that Pharaoh can do nothing else but recognize that he exists and that he is powerful. Look at verse 27 of chapter 9. Quote, "Pharaoh summoned Moses and Aaron. This time I have sinned," he said. "Yahweh is right, and I and my people are in the wrong. Pray to Yahweh, for we have had enough, and I will let you go." Moses replied, "When I have gone out of the city, I will spread out my hands in prayer to Yahweh. The thunder will stop, and there will be no more hail, that you may know that the earth is Yahweh's. But I know that you and your officials still will not fear the Lord God, Yahweh." End quote. So the plagues are a demonstration to Pharaoh of the existence and power of Yahweh, because in that first encounter with Moses, Pharaoh said he didn't know who Yahweh is. But it wasn't just a demonstration to the Egyptians. It's also a demonstration to the Israelites. Look at chapter 10, the first few verses. Quote, "The Lord said to Moses, I have hardened his heart and the heart of his officials so that I might perform these miraculous signs and wonders among them, and that you might tell your children and your grandchildren how I dealt harshly with the Egyptians, and how I performed my signs among them, and that they may know that I am Yahweh." End quote. So it's not just the Egyptians who are to learn from this, but it's the Israelites as well, so they can experience God's existence, power, and pass that down to future generations. Quote, "That they may know that I am Yahweh." End quote. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 34. When Moses is later commenting about this, he says, quote, quote, "Has any God ever tried to take for himself one nation out of another nation, by tests, by miraculous signs and wonders, by war, by a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, or by great and awesome deeds, like all the things the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your very eyes?" Look at verse 35. What a striking statement. Quote, "You were shown these things." End quote. Why? Quote, "So that you might know that Yahweh is God." End quote. "Besides him, there is no other." Quote, "You were shown these things so that you might know that Yahweh is God." End quote. And then that added statement, which is striking at this point of Old Testament revelation, that is clear and simple, as a strong statement as you'll find anywhere. Quote, "There is no other God." End quote. There is only one God. Now, the Israelites needed this. If you go back to Exodus 5, a question was put to Pharaoh at the beginning of chapter 5. Pharaoh said, "I don't know Yahweh." And then there was that oppression with bricks without straw. And the Israelites don't like it, so if you go down to the end of the chapter, you see in verse 21, these foremen of the labor forces come to Moses and Aaron and say, quote, "May the Lord look upon you and judge. You've made us a stench to Pharaoh and his officials, and put a sword in their hands to kill us." End quote. Moses turned to the Lord and prayed, quote, "Why have you brought this trouble against your people and not rescued your people?" End quote. And over in chapter 6, verse 9, quote, Moses reported this to the Israelites. They did not listen to him because of their discouragement and bondage. End quote. The Israelites were discouraged, and the Lord was going to demonstrate to them his existence. We speak of these signs and wonders. Ot is the word in Hebrew for sign. The Theological Word Book of the Old Testament, TWOT, says, quote, "A sign is an action, event, by which a person recognizes, learns, remembers, or perceives the authenticity of something," end quote. That is what's going on here. Both Pharaoh and Israel are learning about the authenticity of Yahweh through what's going on in the signs and wonders. There are 10 plagues. They are arranged in 3 sets of 3, with the climax in the 10th plague, which is the death of the firstborn. So the first 9 plagues are arranged in 3 groups of 3 plagues each, with the climax in the death of the firstborn. The first plague in each group, numbers 1, 4, and 7, is introduced by a warning being given to Pharaoh early in the morning when he went to the Nile River. And you see that in chapter 7, verse 15, where it says, quote, "Go to Pharaoh in the morning as he goes out for a walk. Wait on the bank of the Nile to meet him," end quote. Exodus chapter 8:20 says, quote, "Then the Lord said to Moses, get up early in the morning to confront Pharaoh as he goes to the water and say to him," end quote. And chapter 9, verse 13, quote, "The Lord said to Moses, get up early in the morning and say to Pharaoh, this is what the Lord says," end quote. So you get the same for the first plague for each of those sets of 3. The second plague in each group, numbers 2, 5, and 8, is also introduced by a warning but delivered to Pharaoh, presumably at his palace rather than out by the Nile. You find that in chapter 8, verse 1, chapter 9, verse 1, and chapter 10, verse 1. Quote, "The Lord said to Moses," end quote. 9:1. Quote, "The Lord said to Moses, go to Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart," end quote. The last plague in each series, 3, 6, and 9, seems to have commenced without any warning. In 8:16 you read, quote, "Then the Lord said to Moses, tell Aaron, strike the dust of the ground throughout all the land of Egypt, and all the dust of the land will become gnats," end quote. See, no introduction. He just does it. Chapter 9, verse 8, quote, "The Lord said to Moses, take handfuls of soot from a furnace, toss it into the air. It will become dust over the land of Egypt. Festering boils will break out," end quote. So he just does it. Chapter 10, verse 21, quote, "Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand toward the sky, so the darkness will spread over Egypt, darkness that can be felt. So Moses stretched out his hand, and total darkness covered all Egypt," end quote. So there seems to be a structure and a pattern when we look at the ways these conflicts are arranged. The first plague in each set has a purpose attached to it, and that's something we've already looked at. In chapter 7, verse 17, the purpose is, quote, "By this you will know that I am Yahweh," end quote. Chapter 8, verse 22, quote, "On that day I will deal differently with the land of Goshen, where my people live, where no swarms of flies will be on them, and you will know that I am the Lord," end quote. And again, a purpose clause. And chapter 9, verse 14, quote, "I will send the full force of my plagues against you and your people, so that you may know that there is no one like me in the whole earth," end quote. The first 3 plagues, the water turned to blood, the frogs, and lice, convinced the magicians and sorcerers of Egypt that there's more than magic involved in what is going on. God was at work. In chapter 7, verse 11, where all this starts, after the Lord had told Moses and Aaron in verse 8, quote, "Throw your staff before Pharaoh and it will become a snake," end quote, they do that in verse 10, and you read in verse 11, quote, "Pharaoh summoned the wise men and sorcerers of Egypt, who did the same thing by their secret arts. Each one threw down his staff, which became a snake," end quote. So they kind of duplicated in some way what Moses and Aaron had done. But Aaron's staff swallowed up their staves. quote, "Yet Pharaoh's heart became hard, and he would not listen," end quote. In chapter 7, verse 22, with the water turned into blood, you read that the Egyptian magicians did the same thing. So Pharaoh's heart became hard. In chapter 8, verse 7, with the frogs, quote, "The magicians did the same thing with their secret arts. They made frogs come up from the land of Egypt," end quote. But when you get to 8:18 with the gnats, you read when the magicians tried to produce gnats by their secret arts, but they couldn't. The gnats were on man and animals. Then the magicians said to Pharaoh, quote, "This is the finger of God." But the Pharaoh's heart was hard, end quote. So after those three, the Egyptian magicians are convinced there's something far more powerful at work than mere trickery. One more comment and we'll take our break. With the next six plagues after these first three, with the possible exception of the locusts, you find a kind of discrimination in the effects of the plague between the Egyptians and the Israelites living in Goshen. The Israelites are spared the effects of the plague while the Egyptians are not. I think the purpose here is to make very clear that Yahweh is working on behalf of his people. In chapter 8, verses 21 to 23, with the flies you read, quote, "If you do not let my people go, I will send swarms of flies on you, your officials and your people, and into your houses. I will deal differently with the land of Goshen, where my people are. No swarms of flies will be there," end quote. Why? Again, quote, "So that you will know that I am Yahweh," end quote. "I will make a distinction between my people and your people." So starting with the flies, you get that distinction, and you find that in chapter 8, verses 21 to 23, with the cattle in chapter 9, verse 4, 6, and 7, Exodus 9, 4, quote, "The Lord made a distinction between the livestock," end quote. You have with the boils in chapter 9, verse 11. The magicians could not stand before Moses because of the boils that were on them and all the Egyptians. You have it with the hail in chapter 9, verse 26. Quote, "The only place that did not hail was the land of Goshen, where the Israelites were," end quote. As I mentioned, nothing is said about the locusts one way or the other. But with the darkness, in chapter 10, verse 23, you read, quote, "No one could see anyone else, yet all the Israelites had light in the places where they lived," end quote. So certainly there was a discrimination between the Egyptians and the Israelites, and perhaps with the locusts as well. This is the end.
Dr. Robert Vinoy, Exodus to Exile, Lecture 2A.